feedback on any of our programming, please email us at info@wpfw.org.
Hey, Chris Garlock here.
And I'm Elise Bryant.
Every week, we explore labor arts and culture.
On the Labor Heritage Power Hour.
Thursdays from 1 to 2 p.m.
Right here on WPFW 89.3 FM. That's the Labor Heritage Power Hour.
Thursdays from 1 to 2 p.m.
The heart and soul
of the American labor movement.
I'm Candy Shannon, and you are tuned to member-supported WPFW Washington.
Welcome to On the Margin with E. Ethelbert Miller. My guest today is Abe Van Jordan. Abe Van Jordan is a professor of creative writing at Stanford University. He's written several poetry collections. His latest book is When I Wake, I Cry to Dream Again, published by W.W. Norton and Company. How are you doing today, Van?
I'm good. I'm happy to be here with you.
Well, you know, Van, when I think of Akron, Ohio, I think of LeBron James, Steph Curry, and Abe Van Jordan. James, yeah,
I don't know if Steph Curry thinks of Akron, Ohio. He thinks
of, no, he's born in the same hotel, the same hospital.
Right? I know.
And you probably were born in the hospital too, right?
Probably was, yeah.
Well, you know, they have rings, Van. When you look at your career, what book or award has been the most meaningful to you?
Wow. Well, I have to say the second book, Magnolia, probably was the most meaningful, just because I feel like wherever I go, people always remark on how that book was important to them. I feel like it also put Akron on the map a bit, you know, talking about Magnolia Cox.
Explain who she is, just for our listeners.
So Magnolia Cox was the first African American to get to the final round of the National Spelling Bee in 1936. And she was the, the kind of heir apparent. Like, people thought that she was going to be the winner because from Akron at that time, they had three National Spelling Bee champs in the span of 8 years. And, you know, she's coming from this place that was, you know, was expected. And she was a phenom. Like, she was like LeBron as a speller. Genius, 100,000 words. So she gets to the final round. And then they cheat her out of the win by pulling a word that wasn't on the list. Mm-hmm. And the word, believe it or not, was nemesis. Mm-hmm. And that kind of threw her off her game. And it's a much longer story, but I was very happy when I wrote that book, the response to the book. And it was a persona poem. So, you know, the whole book is in pretty much in persona. And at the time, I had been reading a lot of the AI.
Cruelty, right, yeah.
Yeah, cruelty, greed, all that stuff. And so just studying her work and just really going in on the persona poem. And now we're at the 20th anniversary of it, of that book, you know, and it's just, I mean, I'm talking to you right now from the campus of University of Pittsburgh, Greensburg, where I'm on faculty here with Cave Canem, and I've had several of the fellows come up to me and tell me how important Magnolia was to them. So it means a lot to me. And and then also winning the Ansel Wolf Book Award, to answer the other part of your question, because that award, it's the panel is Henry Louis Gates, Rita Dove, my home girl, my home sister, Simon Sharma, Joyce Carol Oates, having, you know, these intellectual giants choose the book a lot. I got to share it that night with Edris Danicat, and it was in Cleveland, you know, because it's the Cleveland Foundation. And so that I think the award, The actual ceremony, I think it was like on the 28th of September. My father was in the audience, my mom, my brothers, my nephew. And on October 22nd, you know, less than about 4 weeks later, my father died. So it was like the last time, you know, he got to, you know, I saw him upright in a suit, you know, sitting in the audience. I got to read poems and get this award. So it was a great night. It meant a lot.
Mm. Let me add another name that must have meant something to you. Carol Hook Smith.
Oh my God. Yeah. Yeah.
Carol Hook Smith.
Yeah.
Carol
is just a beautiful spirit, man. Like, you know, I think Carol was either late 70s or 80 when I met her, you know, and she was just going strong, you know, in the city. And so I met her at an AWP and Ellen Bryan Voigt had introduced me to her. And, you know, when I was talking to Carol, you know, she says a thing that the editors say, oh, well, you should send me some of your work sometime. And I said, okay, you know, thinking like, there's no way she's going to look at my work. And then Ellen put her hand on my shoulder. She says, no, seriously, send her your work. And so I did. And I've been sending Magnolia out for to different contests, different publishers, like in the open submission period. And I wasn't getting any bites. So I did the National Poetry Series. I sent out for that. And when the list came out, like all my friends were on the list. and I didn't get anything, right? So, and so then I was teaching. And I was teaching a workshop. And I was like talking to this young lady in the workshop, and I was saying the thing about, like, you know, how you're reading a poem and sometimes the ending of the poem is where the poem should begin, and the, you right. know, and I said, you know, I said that little parlor trick of like turning the poem upside down or whatever and see what that does to it. And she had enough sense to ask me, well, why should I do that? And I thought about it, I said, oh yeah. And I said, well, you know, you need to do that because, you know, the poem moves toward transcendence if you change the order. And when I said that, it kind of clicked, you know, for myself, that that's really what I needed to do with my collection, was reverse the order. And so I reversed the order of it, and where I start on Magnolia's deathbed, and I move to the night before the spelling bee, and her moment of her greatest potential. And so I sent it back out. And within a week, I got two offers for the book, and one was Norton. And she just, you know, Carol Hook Smith just called me up on the phone and said, oh, you know, I read your book and I'd like to publish it. I almost fell out my chair, you know.
I'm gonna tell you a secret, man.
Yeah.
I'm gonna tell you a secret. I talked to Carol Hook Smith on the phone, and I said, publish this book.
I'm not surprised.
So I just want to let you know there, but because I met her sitting around a pool in Salt Lake City, you know. But,
oh, really, really?
Yeah, many years ago.
Brother, you know,
very sweet.
I always thank you, but I thank you even more now. So thank you. You know, I was just talking to Peter J. Harris.
Mm-hmm.
Tell you hello, and I was telling him, I said, you know, man, you know, Ethelbert, he's a mover and shaker. You know, and he's always so organized. I said, we were talking. I said, man, I gotta go get ready. I gotta be ready. You know, so, but I appreciate you. I really appreciate
Well, let's go from Akron, Ohio, back to here to DC. You mentioned Peter, you know.
Yeah.
And your first book.
Let me say one more thing about Carol, though. Because I think she was really one of the, like, old school, like, New York editors. And I would come to New York, you know, always had to have lunch with her. You know, she demanded it, you know, but always introduced me to everyone at Norton. So when I would meet her in New York, I'd go there on Fifth Avenue, go in. She introduced me to everyone from the person, like people in the mailroom,
right. Literally
all the way up to the president of Norton. Mm-hmm. And we would go to the Algonquin Hotel and have, you know, lunch and tea, whatever. But just really old school, and just like a beautiful human being. She read everything.
When you say that, that's exactly when I first met her. She said she was old school because we're sitting around this pool in Salt Lake City, right? And she's editing manuscripts. And me and Jason Schindler, who's no longer living, but Jason Schindler and I, we're telling old jokes and stuff like that. We're on vacation. We're supposed to be teaching workshop.
Yeah,
but Carol was in there, like the old school line. line by line and reading.
Line by line, man.
Right,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, let's go back to Rides. We were talking about this is your first book, and,
yes.
and you have two. I want you to read two jazz poems because one is linked to WPFW, but
yeah.
but you also the one I really like is St. John Coltrane African Orthodox Church. So read yeah. that, and then also Public Radio plays Eddie Harris.
Okay, so this is St. John Coltrane African Orthodox Church. Maybe it was the practice of practice, he and Alice in the grocery store, and him fingering keys up and down the aisles. The magic of capturing spirit in a whole note, in a mouthpiece, in Alabama, like light bent through a prism into color. Maybe they figured out his distant relationship to Lazarus in 56, pushing the stone from in front of his open bell, bouncing sound off the east to the west. It was intangible the way he raised a soul to intaglio, like a gospel hymn raises tongues to tones understood only by the secret society of the saxophone. Alice knew the secrets of the stars and the notes in between, the power of laying hands on scales and the baptism into the void between chords and back to bring forth what had not been before Train. It's no surprise to see the church with his face stained in the glass. No questions surround the choir of saxophones, the congregation's many shades of sound. Not the skin, but the sound, not the verse, but the riff, not the jazz, but the spirit. How is this any different from heroin churning a man's soul? If Jesus can turn water into wine, then a junkie can resurrect as a saint. Maybe you have not come to the altar with sucker bites from Satan up and down your arms, taking the fellowship wherever you could find it, blown blood through a horn, shot up with the devil, and felt him ejaculate in your veins. When man is at his weakest, faith has a perfect pitch.
Evan Jordan reading his poem, St. John Coltrane, African Orthodox Church, from his book Rise. And
okay.
you had the public radio plays Eddie Harris.
Yes, yes. This is a true story. Public radio plays Eddie Harris. Clouds stand in protest of morning. I wonder, should I cross the picket line sky and go to work? The 70 bus stood me up for an 8:32 a.m. date. Headlines say I voted for a man who cheated on his wife. By 2 p.m., my body's at war with a virus. I am now blue fire. My throat is lined with cactus. There was no mention of this in the morning paper. I crawl back home to my room. My bed sheets are cold. At 10 p.m., a call of bad news from my family, something about a car and my brother. Doctors say he may never dance again. This chord of bad news accompanies today's riff. Folks have gone on strike in heaven. Sweat pours off the shoulders of the night. No need for liquids and drugs. I'm already dead. If WPFW-FM can't resurrect me, Lazarus was a liar. Thank God they're playing Eddie Harris. I have friends who are atheists. I have ammunition for our next argument. They play four Eddie Harris tunes in a row. Faith healers are tuning in. I'm all but cured when they make the announcement. Eddie Harris died today. Thoughts tornado over my bed. It pirouettes over the city with hips like my mama's. Eddie always said there's no such thing as a wrong note, only bad connections to the next. I put the alarm clock under the sheets. In the morning, it will sound like music.
Thank you, Adrian Jordan. Van, what makes a good jazz poem? You know, I'm listening to you. It's not necessarily the content, but you also sometimes have the rhythms. You know, sometimes a jazz poem, people think it's because you make a reference to Miles Davis, so it's a jazz poem.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I mean, I think it's a lot like, I mean, I think it is the tradition of the ekphrastic poem. Like, you know, you're sort of describing another art form inside of the poem. And, you know, I always tell people that it can't just be like you can't be liner notes. Like you can't just describe it or sort of talk about it. You have to bring something to it that that adds to the experience of the music. And so for me, I feel like it has to be personalized in some way. Mm-hmm. You know, so there's something very specific about the experience of listening to it that you're trying to capture. Something very specific about what it does to you internally. and you're trying to express that. Because, you know, I can tell someone, oh man, you should listen to Coltrane. He's great. Or I can say, you know, Eddie Harris is like, you know, beautiful improviser or whatever, but it doesn't mean anything unless I can talk about what it does to me.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's look at, your latest book, When I Wake, I Cry to Dream Again. When I picked up this book, I found myself going back to your notes in the back. That's what I'm doing at first, right? When are notes necessary in a poetry book?
Yeah. Well, you know, this book, the concept of it was something that, speaking of editors, I'll tell you, so like when I was writing this book, I was working on it and I just felt like I didn't know how to present it to folks. And then my editor, Jill Belowski, now that Carol has passed on, Jill Belowski had, you know, she just called and said, what are you working on? You know, I told her about this book and she said, I want to see some of it. But it's so hard to explain to people because it's looking at specifically at various Shakespearean characters and the experience of like what it's like to be a Black character on the, you know, on the Renaissance stage. Folks, you know, you come out on stage you know, when that character appears, they're already seen, you know, the audience already has made up their mind about who this person is. Mm-hmm. And the thing that Shakespeare would do is that, you know, he would have other characters talk about characters before they appeared. And sometimes it would be to ennoble them. So like, you know, the first time you hear Hamlet's name, it's Valiant Hamlet. So by the time Hamlet shows up, there he is, Valiant, you know. You know, Iago, you know, he's, you know, besmirching the character of Othello before he appears. And we hear Prospero doing the same thing with Caliban, you know. And so in my mind, it was very similar to the ways in which police, you know, they hear something about, oh, this is a Black man who's, you know, done something. And they show up on the scene already made with their mind made up.
Okay, I'm gonna get into that because that gets into the book. But I wanna stay on this point about the notes. Because you explained that you were here and dealing with the Kaveh Khan group.
Yeah.
So I'm looking at what happens sometime in a class where poetry is being discussed. The question comes back, how much should a poet explain to the reader, and when should a poet make a reader sweat?
Well, I think a poet should always make a reader sweat. You know, I mean, like...
You're talking about James Brown now.
Yeah, exactly. Right. I think that it's important for, you know, the reader to come to poetry for something they can't get anywhere else. And, you know, I believe that poetry is the highest form of language, so it has to be the highest form of experience in the written arts, you know. So you want to bring something that they can't get anywhere else from it. So and the other thing is that I feel like in most of our days, like you go through your day, we're taking in information and there's a lot of chatter, news and other things, and now with social media, but there's not a lot of time to kind of sit with something and let it just a light on a moment of thought, like on a topic or anything. So we don't get enough time. I don't think we have the luxury of time to kind of meditate on things before we make judgment on them. Mm-hmm. And I think poems, they call for that. They call for you to sort of slow down for a moment and just think about this and take it seriously. I'm sorry. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, then. As we have this slowing down, I want to link something back to what you were talking about when you were talking about Magnolia, because I saw that as your transitional book coming after Rides, which actually won the Penn Oakland Josephine Miles Award. But in Magnolia, we see using what I call the definition as a poetic form. And I wonder about, is that your creation? Or was this also outgrowth of the fact that you're dealing with Magnolia, which is dealing with spelling? And the form begins with Magnolia also.
Both, yeah. So I hadn't seen it anywhere before, and I actually searched out to try to see, and There are some things that Gertrude Stein had done, you know, similarly, but, you know, inscrutably, you know, but in terms of like thinking about the definition, the dictionary definition as a form for the poem. Yeah. So I invented that, but I did it for specifically to serve that book. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's become handy in other.
Let's talk about something here, because a few weeks ago, I interviewed Edward Hirsch, and, you know, he has this glossary, you know, and we were talking about definitions, and I made reference to how African-Americans were creating forms.
Yeah.
You know, the bop, you know, skimmy, shimmy, all those things. And here you are, you're also in terms of creating forms. And I was wondering whether
I'm African-American too. So I'm African-American too.
Yeah. Oh, I didn't know. That's why I'm glad we're doing it. We have a Zoom link.
Yeah,
radio can fool anybody.
I want to get in on that. You know?
But, you know, what I was looking at was the fact that, you know, and it's interesting that you had at Copycana, because, you know, one of the things that I always looked at when it got into, like, African-Americans doing stuff, the craft element was always put aside. Like, you know, we just mix it up like it was magic, you know, and we did it.
Yeah.
Or we're just a born athlete, you know, we don't have to really do anything with craft. And I was wondering in terms of, you know, getting recognition for this, you know, where you are, you know, I'm making you sound like, you know, you're Karanga, you're coming up with Kwanzaa.
No, you know, man, it's like, I appreciate that. You know, I feel like I've seen so many poets come up behind me who've used the form and have imitated the form. And there have been like dictionary poem, poetry contests and things like that that have happened in different universities and things that I've been invited to. So I see the form. It has developed. I've seen people do interesting things with it and kind of variations of that form.
Should this definition be seen as a prose poem?
I think so. So the thing about it, the thing I like about the form is that it's flexible enough to kind of be a mix of the kind of lyrical and the narrative at once. And you know, and it also, it just sort of pushes the writer to think about something with a little more rigor, because now you have this one restriction that you put on it. It has to like follow these definitions, right, and variations of the word. And so now that,
but then I also see you with, even though when you have this formal definition, we see this sort of like how like a black person will put a little slant on their hat. That you have, yeah, there's a definition, but there's also like the black definition.
Yeah. So you want to put
a little pork in the pot, right?
Yeah. You want to put your own style on it, right? You know. So and that's the thing about it. Like, you know, it's not Merriam-Webster. You know, it has to be your voice. And so you have to hear something that you wouldn't, like, just like what you're saying about jazz, you know, something that you wouldn't hear if you went into a dictionary, you know. So you have this definition, but it's like as if this definition was written specifically for you, you know.
Well, how do you decide, okay, you're writing you have your collection of poems, you're writing these poems, yeah, about whether it's Magnolia or whether it's this new book that you're dealing with. How do you decide that this is the word that I want to use as a definition, that I want to define in the manuscript?
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you.
Worry about that. It's okay. It's radio. Okay. We can't see that.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So the thing is with the Magnolia, I was trying to look at the spelling bee words, mm-hmm, and trying to like come up with a definition for those, and it just wasn't worth it. It just wasn't good, you know. So I was trying, and I thought, oh man, you know, this seems like it's not it was a bad idea. It wasn't, you know, using these like spelling bee words in this poems. And as I was looking them up, I was running across the definitions of prepositions. Mm-hmm. And you know, as you're a poet, you're thinking about verbs and nouns, because those are the words that really carry the imagery in the poem. But then prepositions become words that are kind of like the link, you you know, to the connective tissue between those images, right? Mm-hmm. And so I thought, what happens if I privilege these? And I would see that the definition of these prepositions were so long, you know, in the Oxford English Dictionary. And I thought, well, man, do I know the definition of from or to? You know what I mean? Like,
right.
And so, and as I would read them, I could see a narrative kind of developing. So I was trying to do that. And when I waked, the idea was to take words that had become just vernacular or parlance of, mm-hmm. you know, of kind of everyday speech that we may not realize came out of like racist intent, like mm-hmm. words like fair or grandfather clause.
Or juvenile,
right. You know, like that kind of, you know, things that, you know, we find out, oh, you know, this word is being used against me right. some way right. in trying to take right. it back.
Well, I want to ask you one question before we take the break so that the second half of our show will be the, you know, you talking about and reading from When I Wake, I Cry to Dream Again. You know, when I look at your work, Van, it seems like conceptual art. You know, it seems like it's a sculpture or an installation. And so I was looking at how you have these four sections of your books, and I was wondering how they intersect and interact. And because I felt after reading the book, if I was teaching this book, I would begin with the title poem, okay? Because that introduces Dr. Melba Higginbotham, and that seems to be the key. Talk about Dr. Melba Higginbotham and how you introduce that character into the book in that section, and then we'll pick it up after the break. So this will be...
Okay, so Melba Higginbotham, you know, she's like kind of a composite of different Black women scholars. I have to say... The person I had in mind, this is not someone I know, but when I've seen her at conferences and the work I've read, was Horton Spillers. Mm-hmm. You know, someone who had that kind of gravitas and just intellect. You know, and so in writing about her, I wanted someone who could carry, you know, the keeper of the record, who could hold all that intellectual knowledge and sort of pass it down. The idea of that, I, we can call it a poem, we can call it prose or whatever we want to, however you want to approach it. But
this is what I would say when I saw this, and maybe because my friend Miho's influence on me, I saw this as a Japanese form where you have like, you know, haiku, like a hybrid, you know, where you have poetry would be haiku, and then a prose. That's how I was looking at it in terms of the structure.
Yeah. Thanks. So that was kind of the idea. I mean, it was like, you know, just kind of movement. You know, there's so many, I was thinking about different hybrid books. Dante's Vita Nuova, Jean Toomer's Cain, you know, books that kind of move between verse and prose. That I wanted it to sort of hold everything in it. You know,
now focus in on terms of Dr. Melba Higginbotham. She's a Shakespearean scholar, okay?
Yeah.
And this has a lot to do with the Tempest and the whole structure. That's why I said we begin with this section, which is the title of the book, and then we figure out the rest.
Yeah. So Higginbotham, like she's a Shakespearean scholar, so she can explain the importance of looking at Shakespeare and then why it's important for us to think about it in terms of race today. And the complexity of Shakespeare's thinking and how subversive in many ways he was. You know, because I think sometimes people are very quick to say, oh, you know, Shakespeare was kind of racist. He did, you know, Othello, these characters, Caliban. But then when you think about what was happening at the time that he was writing each of those characters, you find out, oh, you know, there was, you know, Queen Elizabeth was like trying to kick out the blackamoors, not just Moors, but because some people say, well, you know, it's a Spanish Moor. No, she specifically said the black Moors, you know. So if you were Moor and you were from Spain and you were white, you could stay.
Right.
But she was trying to get rid of that to, for the, you know, sounds like, you know, the orange one talking about make America great.
Getting rid of the stain.
the stain, yeah, you know. And so... Yeah, so you know, this was the whole thing that I think Higginbotham could embody. Like she could talk about this and explain, and she basically tells us, you know, this is why we're looking at this. You know, why is it
you're talking about yeah. Ichabod, but this is actually you, A. Van Jordan, who created this character.
Yeah.
And this is how you're putting together this book. Okay, exactly. We're going to take a break. My guest today is A. Van Jordan. We're talking about his book, When I Waked, I Cried a Dream Again. The show's on the margin. My name is Ethelbert Miller. The station's WPFW 89.3 FM. Okay, we're back on the margin with my guest, A. Van Jordan. A. Van, I wanted you, to talk, read from this book. I wanted you to read the Samir Rice poems, which I find interesting because, you know, we were talking about Shakespeare, but you have the Samir Rice poems here, and it seems that I like how they connect to the poems of the young people photographed in Mali by the photographer Malik Sadabi. So talk about that, but first read these sections, you know, as along with the note that's at the back, so people get a sense of how you created this character in this poem.
Okay, so I'm sorry, you want me to read the note?
I want you to read first the poem and then the note.
Okay, all right.
Yeah, so people get the poems.
Is there a specific poem you want me to do?
Well, I wanted you to read the ones that begins with Tamir Rice cave. You could read that, and then it's Earsoft. Okay. And fragments of Tamir's body.
Okay.
And then the notes that's at the back.
Okay. So so the Tamir Rice case, I'll read that part first. Yeah. On November 22nd, 2014, when officers Timothy Lohman and Frank Garmbach arrived at the Cuddle Recreation Center's gazebo, this is in Cleveland, driving their squad car on the grass directly in front of the picnic table at which Tamir Rice sat. Tamir got up, seeing a police car coming in hot at high speed, driving on grass in the middle of the park and barely coming to a stop in front of you. Who wouldn't get up from their seat? Initially, the report said that the officer shot within 2 seconds of seeing Tamir. But if you watch the video, as I have many times now, you'll see that the car hasn't settled to a stop before Tamir is shot. Later, it's revealed that they shot him less than 2 seconds after pulling up. The timing of the killing is important. An argument made about the shooting, an argument that allowed the officers to justify their shooting, is that the airsoft pellet gun Tamir was carrying looked a good deal like a real Colt M1911 semi-automatic pistol. But this would only be important if Tamir had a chance to pull out the toy and if the officers had time to see it and to assess whether it looked lethal. If you shoot someone before they have a chance to resist or to pull a weapon or to issue a threat, are you really killing them because you feel threatened? What then could you be threatened by seeing a 12-year-old boy, black boy, standing in front of you? And so here's a poem, Airsoft. Like a whisper from a friend telling a secret, the gun reveals itself only to invite, not start any trouble, mind you, just to invite the boy who listens to come out to play. And the boy knows not so much what the gun's pellet says as he understands what the pellet will mean to say, whistling through a windy afternoon past onlookers who neither hear nor see the streak of inhuman intent searing through the ether. So he takes his airsoft pellet gun in hand, as he might take his laces in hand to tighten them more securely around his juvenile ankles. That's to say, without much care, but just out of habit before taking off to run. Everyone runs faster with tight laces. This makes sense, of course. And the hope to run can excite as much as hitting full stride with wind washing over a boy's face. And toy guns masquerade as lethal guns in a boy's dreamland where no one dies, where they simply lie down and play dead, but they live to play on. A mystery is mysterious as a cat in a box, a toy gun in a black boy's pocket, the gun neither dead nor alive unless offered a chance to empty his pockets to solve the paradox of what a day might hold.
A. Van Jordan reading from his book, When I Walked, I Cried to Dream Again. So why don't you also read Fragments of Tamir's Body?
Okay. This is Fragments of Tamir's Body. It has an epigraph from Hamlet. I am dead, thou livest, report, thou who livest, report me and my cause all right to the unsatisfied. Fragments of Tamir's Body. The body's shadow had much to say, but no one in earshot understood its language. The clouds stood heavy, And when the cops confronted the body, the boy showed his prowess to indulge in play, just one of his many gifts which scared onlookers. No black man appeared in the park, just a child, just people judging him. As he approached, she wondered how she explained him to her father. The opportunities for joy presented themselves in more colors than the boy could name, so he chose black, enjoying them all. Passersby who laughed at him showed their gratitude by memorizing his face, then by wielding his visage whenever they found themselves in a jam. Was his laughter a declaration of his joy or a sacred prayer offered over poor souls resigned to their fate? Corn chips, black licorice, marbles, plastic pellets, toy gun, jawbreakers, bubblegum, crushed apogee of memory. When he imagines knowing then what he now knows, he imagines dying before his time. A jar of preserved pears, canned by his grandmother, occupies his mind. When he gets home, a man beats a drum in courtship to his beloved. Nah, a boy dribbles a basketball, boasting of his youth. A saga took place in the mind of the police as they glimpsed the black child who was caught smiling as he walked toward them. His sister's scream, pulled from a well too black to ring shallow, echoes whenever his name.
Hey, Van Jordan. Hey, I want you now to read the notes, because if I was a reader, I read these poems, and now I go to the back of the book, and I'm looking on page 113, I'm looking at your notes, and you have the Tempest and the Tamir Rice case sequence.
Yes, yes. Okay, so should I read the whole thing?
Yeah, read the whole thing, because I think it'll explain to our listeners exactly how you go from the poem and why the notes add something to the poems.
Okay, so one of the biggest surprises I've experienced in middle age is my involuntary desire to protect young people. I've read that the brain's chemistry shifts in your 40s and empathy gets an upgrade. There's other research to the contrary, though, that shows that many people harden in their tendency to believe in stereotypes, which amplifies their impulse for othering. For myself, at least, I know here in my 50s, I'm surprised at what brings tears to my eyes for others, whether witnessing their joy or their pain. So when I hear reports of adults in uniform justifying why they felt the need to shoot a child on sight in less than 2 seconds, I'm clear that this person is not psychologically equipped to carry a weapon. From where does an idea like a black body presents a threat emerge? When did the Western world begin thinking of the black body both as undesirable and as a hypersexualized object, as both necessary for slave labor and yet lazy, or as a threat and all at once as a joke? Wondering about these origins has not risen to the nomenclature of cliche. No, sadly, we don't ask these questions enough. I have been thinking about this topic since I was a child standing with a white adult pointing a gun in my face, and the many cliche encounters that followed throughout my life. We black people are taught that the best strategy to survive these stinging moments of life-threatening racism is to stay calm. But I want to know, what was the fillip that lit this insidious flame? I'm not alone in my inquiry. Early modernist scholars, particularly African-American Shakespearean scholars, have been going in on this topic for a minute now. In the Cambridge Companion to Shakespeare and Race, Patricia Akimi locates the seriousness in racist humor in the early modern period in her chapter, Racist Humor and Shakespearean Comedy. One moment stands out in bold relief to me when she points out that Shakespearean racist humor reveals the production of maintenance of groups, processes of inclusion and exclusion, and of hierarchization. These are the building blocks of racism. And building on this point, she goes on in a whole theater of others, an episode of the Folger Shakespeare Library, Shakespeare Unlimited podcast, to say, how are stereotypes created and how are they maintained? One of the ways is through communal laughter, which is to say, those in on the joke laugh at those who are othered. Over time, something as seemingly simple as ridicule devolves into justifying violence against the ridiculed.
Thank you, Evan Jordan, I want to go back to the Airsoft poem that you read, because when I read it, I circled in the sixth stanza the word juvenile, because that will be a term that you'll use the poetic definition, you know, in the book. And that also leads us into the photographs and this project that you worked on in terms of with the Mali photographer on Sadabi. So talk about how this flows together.
Part of it was thinking about the ways in which Black joy can be snuffed out, which kind of goes back to Magnolia as well. You know, the idea that, you know, this is a very fragile time. It's an important time, because any, you know, significant experience you have as a tween or a teen can be indelible. You know, as my mom would say, this had this old saying, you know, as a twig is bent, so grows the tree. You know, and so you have these moments when you think, you know, this is so important. But then when I would see a story like, Tamir Rice or Trayvon Martin or Michael Brown, any of these like young men, you know, I think how their lives were snuffed out before they even had a chance, you know, to develop. And, you know, so and thinking about being a juvenile, you know, so you can see it on one hand. Sometimes the word is used pejoratively, and sometimes it's just a way of describing an age group.
Mm-hmm. Well, bring that into this age group, because if I pick up this book, if I'm in a bookstore and I pick up your book, there's photographs in it, and these are photographs of juveniles in Mali.
Yeah. So Malik Sidibe, the Malian photographer, what he was doing at the time was, as Mali was going through its liberation, the idea was that the elders, you know, their one generation was saying, look, we're going to get back to our roots. We're going to stick with our culture, you know, the religion, the language, the garb that we're wearing, everything, you know, is going to be Malian. And then the young people were like, wait a minute, you know, this Motown happening, you know, James Brown is doing his thing, the civil rights movement is happening, but, you know, Black arts movement, all this stuff is happening. And so they're reading Ebony magazine, you know, they've seen what was going on, listening to the music.
They have afros.
Afros, you know what I mean? So they were out, you know, they would go out in their traditional garb, but underneath it, they would have on these little suits, mini dresses like the Supremes, mm-hmm. you know, all that stuff. And they would go out to these undisclosed locations that are just like word of mouth. And they show up and they take the African garb off and they would, you know, dance and take photographs, you know. And Sidibe was there taking their photographs and kind of chronicling this moment. It was just to see the contrast of young people expressing their joy together on their own terms, and just sort of seeing that in contrast to these lives that were being, you know, extinguished when they were just getting started.
Yeah, this is why, you know, Evangeline, I like your work, because it lends itself to a lot of discussion. You know, it's not a quick read. It's not necessarily easy read. I want to mention for Rise that if I was teaching, I would put you right next to it. I say, okay, we're going to read so-and-so, and then Evan Jordan. And I want to know whether these Rise in any way have any sort of influence on you. Sort of like a downbeat test or something like that.
Okay. I'll just listen.
There's four names. Okay. One is Derek Walcott. Okay. The second is Jay Wright. The third is Nathaniel Mackey. And the fourth is Bob Kaufman.
Oh, wow. Wow. I mean, I can't imagine doing what I do without having read any one of those.
Right. Well, so with Derek, let's go through them. Let's go through Derek Walcott, because I was thinking of this very ambitious, you know, Searles, you know, I was just thinking it was great work, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Listen, you read someone like Walcott, and, you know, I often tell my students, like, the first day of class, that the most underrated form of genius is discipline, you know. And you look at someone like Walcott and his attention, not just to syntax, but to accentual syllabic verse and the way he's, you know, even when he's writing what is seemingly free verse, there's so much rigor on the line. Yeah, you can't escape it. And someone who doesn't know poetry, you might hear it and you just hear the music of it. But if you know how this thing is made, I mean, it's you know, everything's a masterpiece, you know. So yeah.
You know, I heard Derek Walcott read one time, I think it was at George Mason University, and his voice it has been in my ear since then, you know. And what I also liked is he read his poem, and he was like a little Miles Davis. He wasn't even looking at the audience, you know. Right. He was looking at one of these Caribbean waves coming in, you know. Sitting at the beach, yeah. And, you know, and you guys could be there. What about Jay Wright? Because Kaveh Khan just was honoring Jay Wright. Jay Wright is one person that I continue to correspond, and I have a number of unpublished manuscripts in my archives from Jay Wright, you know. So I keep saving everything that he sent me. But what about him? Because it seems as if he was just discovered by Kaveh Khan recently.
Yeah, I mean, I think Jay Wright's one of these poets who everyone who's a poet respects him and understands that he's a great intellect. But you know, he's not a name that if you're not a poet, you would never necessarily know. And I think one of the things that I like about Jay Wright is his sense of how to use, you know, symbols, language, and themes of a culture, you know, iconography inside of his poetry. And same like Walcott, he's applying a great deal of craft to that. So it's not just, I'm just, you know, sitting somewhere thinking about the Southwest and, right. And you know, the Black connection to, you know, this land and this, you know, Aztec, you know, culture and things like that. He's thinking about, you know, how do I represent this,
right.
You know, in the language and the complexity of it in the language. He's also, like, the thing about all these poets that you've mentioned is that, I think if I, they're sort of both lyrical, and then some are, they probably would say, oh, a little more experimental in ways, but they're all distinctly, they have very distinct voices.
Your voice has become very distinct, and has a lot to do with you creating these forms also. But what I looked at, and I looked at Nathaniel Mackey, you know, what happens if I don't know certain things, I can't have an appreciation. You know, I'm going to get into Dogon culture and stuff like that, you know. I also saw something which I'm glad I was witness to. I remember Nathaniel Mackey was here many years ago. He was a writer in residence for the WPA, Watch Project for the Arts. And I brought him up to Howard University. I said, you got to see something here. And it was a show by the sculptor Ed Love. And what happened, I still remember Nathaniel Mackey in the doorway of the gallery up at Howard saying, like, man, like, this is what I've been writing about, right? You know, on the next cover of Hambone magazine that he was putting out was Ed Love's sculpture on the cover. But when I say that, it goes back to what I was describing to you about you creating sculpture and installation, that I see your work having that same type of level as Nathaniel Mackey, that you have to prepare yourself. Like, for example, I've got to know something about The Tempest. I've got to know about Shakespeare. I've got to know about Ira Aldridge. I've got to know about all those things. I guess if you're a Howard student going into the theater, you know, I've got to know who Ira Aldridge is.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's the first time I heard his name.
Oh, at Howard.
At Howard. You know, yeah. I said, who's Ira Aldridge? You know, yeah.
And because of your book, I realized this guy is buried in Poland. So thank you, A. Van Jordan.
That's so funny.
But I want to, before we come to the end of the show, I want to raise something which is very important to you. And we mentioned a number of books, but we didn't mention Kipo. You have a strong interest in film. And even in this book, When I Wake, I Cry to Dream Again, there is a reference to Charles Burnett's 1978 film, Killer of Sheep. Mm-hmm. Talk about that film and your interest in film as we move towards the end of our show. And you have a collection that you really highlight film.
Yeah. Well, Killer of Sheep, you know, Burnett, you know, it's just like, the thing about Charles Burnett is that, you know, when you look at this guy, neorealism, mm-hmm. the idea of just kind of capturing everyday life. And in that film, he captures both the kind of joy of being young, and also, and Killer Sheep I'm talking about, the joy of being young, and also the struggles that are all around on that while you're trying to like hold on to your joy, hold on to your youth. There are all these moments that kind of like grow you up fast, right. And you have to kind of deal that with that and sort of witness that. Because you're just trying to be a kid, but then your parents are struggling to try to like, you know, allow you to have a place to live and lay your head and some food to eat, you know, while you're going out to play. And so just the ability that he was, you know, able to capture of like just putting the camera there and capture those moments. It's almost like seeing animated version of him looking at.
Well, you know, the film gave me an idea, you know, taking place in September, we would show up.
Like, yeah, let's
do it. We do two, and you know, you, wow. But look, I will have time. But, you know, especially to teach the next.
It's certainly important to write about, but first order of business for the poet is to chronicle, you know, and for them to know it and to carry it on, what this is really all about, whose culture, job of other people to try to extinguish it. But we keep coming back, you know, we keep showing up and we keep creating the culture and evolving the culture. And so we have to write about it.
I think of one writer who captures that, but then doesn't stop there, because I think of where he, because of his faith and things that lead him. But I look at how Robert Hayden will give us these fantastic poems about race. But then he's also in American Journal, he will talk about extraterrestrials coming. And, you know, he's a Baha'i. His work is, you know, moving beyond race. And so I see him as a definite individual who should be highlighted to the next generation of African-American poets, because he shows up a certain path of how you can be rooted in your culture, but then also in terms of how you can also transcend your culture without that being negative.
Yeah. I Hayden's my North Star, man. Like he's the poet that if I think about a poet who I'm consciously thinking of when I'm writing, he's the North Star.
See, so you know? Because you say that, see, now this, because you said that, it's at the end of our show. You mentioned about how he's the North Star. So now there's an indication you do not want to wear your dog mask because the hounds are chasing you and you'll never get. See, so you either have to be a hound or you have to decide that your eye is going to be on the North Star.
I don't know.
So you get the North Star. I'm going to just say bow wow and goodbye.
Okay.
Man, I want to say I always enjoy talking to you, and you're a person I admire. And I'm happy that you're passing on, you know, your not just your work, but your personality and who you are to another generation of African-American poets, okay? My guest today has been A. Van Jordan. He's a professor of creative writing at Stanford University. And we've been talking about his new book, When I Wake, I Cry to Dream Again, which is a new book published by W.W. Norton and Company. My name is Ethelbert Miller. The show's On the Margins. The station's WPFW 89.3 FM.
Returns to WPFW beginning Monday, July 29th, 2 a.m. till 5 a.m. with Music Memories, the best of old school from the 50s, 60s, and 70s. Yes, the return of Alvin Nedab on 89.3 WPFW FM, Monday, July 29th, 2 a.m. to 5 a.m. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
The Birchmere welcomes Lady Smith Black Mambazo, Tuesday, July 30th. Nelson Mandela titled them South Africa's cultural ambassadors to the world. Details at birchmere.com.
Greetings. WPFW is pleased to announce the relaunch of our major donor program, now known as the Jazz and Justice Circle. If you gave $1,000 last year or so far this year, you are automatically enrolled in this cherished group of listener members, and we thank you. Benefits of your membership are at wpfwfm.org under the Support Us tab at the top of the homepage is the Jazz and Justice Circle. Interested in joining this select group? Please consider a donation of $1,000 or more online at wpfwfm.org. Your donation helps WPFW build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
WPFW presents Democracy Now!'s coverage of the Republican National Convention, Monday, July 15th through Friday, July 19th at 11 a.m. It is your support that makes this possible. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
The Institute for Policy Studies, the Wallace Global Fund, and The Nation invite you to their first annual Henry A. Wallace Symposium, Countering American Fascism, Lessons from Organizing in the U.S. Heartland, on Monday, July 22nd from 6:30 to 8 p.m. Speakers include National Affairs Correspondent for The Nation, John Nichols, Salma Arias of People's Action, and IPS Executive Director Tope Falerin. That's Countering American Fascism, Lessons from Organizing in the U.S. Heartland, Monday, July 22nd, 6:30 to 8 p.m. at the 14th and V Streets Busboys and Poets. More information and how to RSVP can be found online, ips-dc.org/events/countering-american-fascism.
WPFW, your station for jazz and justice, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Hello, WPFW.
Summertime is here. Words Beats in Life and Arts for Everybody have the event for your family and friends this season. DMV Made Festival is happening Saturday, July 27th on the National Mall, a one-day celebration of the D.C., Maryland, Virginia region, promoting the intersections of arts and culture, plus health and wellness. Featuring musical acts, Chuck Brown Band, Sweet Honey and the Rock, Substantial, Belladonna, DuPont Brass, and just added, The Blackbirds, celebrating 50 years of their classic, Rock Creek Park, plus four more music and dance stages, Family Fun Zone, Poetry and Storytelling Pavilion, live art installations, hands-on workshop tent, and health and wellness pavilion. Free to the entire community. July 27th on the National Mall. DMV Made Festival. Get more information and RSVP today. WBLINC.org/DMV Made.
The Institute for Policy Studies, the Wallace Global Fund, and The Nation invite you to their first annual Henry A. Wallace Symposium, Countering American Fascism, Lessons from Organizing in the U.S. Heartland, on Monday, July 22nd from 6:30 to 8 p.m. Speakers include National Affairs Correspondent for The Nation, John Nichols, Salma Arias of People's Action, and IPS Executive Director Tope Falerin. That's Countering American Fascism, Lessons from Organizing in the U.S. Heartland, Monday, July 22nd, 6:30 to 8 p.m. at the 14th and V Streets Busboys and Poets. More information and how to RSVP.